Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
I'm delighted to have back John McMurtry. John has so many distinguished credentials. He's an internationally recognized moral and political philosopher, an elected fellow of the Royal Society of Canada, a university professor emeritus at the University of Guelph in Ontario. Oh, he's written so many important works, his volumes on philosophy and world problems for UNESCO have been globally published, and his books have been widely translated. They include Unequal Freedoms, The Cancer Stage of Capitalism, and Value Wars. John is also a very active public advocate for global justice, world peace, and international law. And I must say that there's very little of that around now. And unfortunately, the country that I live in, America, and the one that John lives in, just north in Canada, both countries have a very close alliance affiliated in waging endless imperial wars. If one ends, they simply can't wait to begin another one. It doesn't matter how much human misery, how many people are killed, how much destruction. I think all the time that, especially after America exported its industrial base to China and Bangladesh and other countries around the world, I keep thinking that the only thing America has or is retaining expertise in is military power to kill and destroy. There is no other country in the world that can match America on that. In fact, off the top of my head, I can't think of many, if any, that are running around waging war, certainly ones that make headlines. I literally cannot think of a war making headlines waged by any other country except America and America's allies that it either enlists or it oppresses or it, dare I say, terrorizes the smaller ones. I'm not certain how much terror they inflict on Britain and France, but they sure can inflict an awful lot of pressure to get them to go along with their imperial wars. You know, the so-called Coalition of the Willing, or whatever name they've given to the Libyan adventure. You remember that was the one that was started off being called Operation... Odyssey Dawn, Operation Odyssey Dawn. I don't know where they come up with these names. Well, that didn't last very long. It kind of slipped away under the radar, and now it's called, again, Orwell would understand this better than any of us. Now it's called Operation Unified Protector. They're right, but they don't tell us what they're protecting. They're not protecting the Libyans. They're protecting the wealth and power, mainly of America and their imperial allies. And to do that, they're slaughtering Libyans to protect them, to save them. John, I could keep this thing going. I'm so outraged. I spoke a lot about it yesterday, as I said to friends, my Chicago TV debut. it was not on one of the commercial networks. It was on Chicago local access television. It's a very low budget operation. I don't know how many people watch, but I had a few call-ins that were very supportive, and my host loved it. He invited me back. John, welcome.
Oh, it's good to be back, Steve.
Oh, my goodness. I know one thing that you and I chatted about in emails was one of the great media crimes, not just the obvious one of misreporting and distorting.
Oh, yeah. Well, and inverting. I mean, as you say, the what it's protecting, there's many ways we can go at this, and it takes us to deeper and deeper levels of really a system that almost spontaneously discharges, has to, in order to keep its to keep going, and not only on the level. Well, we see it with the Gaddafi, the war against Gaddafi in a small Libya, and I think we've discussed what a paradigm example it is of just the U.S. armed force, military, state, security state aggression against other countries, always in violation of international law. And I've gone through all the international laws it is in violation of, a number of which the U.S. refuses to sign. For example, it will not sign on to the International Court of Justice, though it applies it against everybody else. It won't sign on precisely because this is the way it protects itself, Operation Protect Self. And what it's doing in Libya is just like Iraq all over again. You know, we talk about a revolutionary despot and the despot, the criminal despot has to be, and all attention focuses on the evil one, the great Satan, whoever it might be. You can just put into the logical space whoever they attack. That's always what they do. Whether it's Saddam or Gaddafi. And in these cases, too, it's very interesting to see that the reasons and the justification for saying that this person is a criminal, barbaric despot, and so forth, the great evil one, the reasons and the documentation for, their evil is always lacking. And we noticed that with the Iraq war, where they said it was weapons of mass destruction, which did not exist, and that was the whole pretext of the war. And now, very interestingly, we had that happening again in Libya, where the claim of what a despot and, continuous crimes against humanity and so forth. We had no evidence of that given in launching this latest war under the claim that it was protecting the citizens of Libya while in Orwellian fashion bombing them and bombing central cities and the rest of it, and especially infrastructures. So we just don't, it really works out as a big lie right from the start. And that was almost something I overlooked until just recently, thinking, well, what is the evidence they have given for the great problem that they're having here with the potential slaughter of civilians and so forth? We really had no evidence given of that. And now we have evidence being covered up of, in fact, the atrocities are happening the other way around. And then we have always the bombing of public infrastructures. That's always what happens most prominently and most importantly. Social infrastructures, socially owned infrastructures. That's always what they go for, first of all. It would be a mistake to get caught up simply on the lives that are murdered. And under international law, it is murder. It's really trying to destroy any alternative substructure, and especially one that sits on oil, and that's always, really obviously what they want, is to destroy this public infrastructure. And then always, as before, we have international crimes. We have war crimes. We have crimes against humanity, and none of that is ever mentioned as an issue. It's always the other guy for which we have no documentation, really, and we have no documentation of what the resistance they're standing for, what the really an armed uprising is standing for. In fact, the person who leads that armed uprising is Gaddafi's own long-term central officer for all the crimes he's supposed to have committed, like the Home Office is in Britain. He was the sort of Minister of Security, and he is the one that's leading this. He's basically somebody who wants the power instead. And of course, this isn't new to us either. is that the person that we're fighting for and that we're protecting and that we're standing for is in fact just another one that, well, worse than the one before, because this one is just a pure opportunist. He worked for Gaddafi for a long time, and he'll just be the way in which we bring in, you know, we get Western control of Libyan oil. And all the while, committing these crimes against humanity, and of course under international law, invasion of a country who is not a belligerent nation and who's not in self-defense is a war crime. I mean, that's just, that's the crime against the war crime, and crimes against peace is a planning and preparation and initiation of a waging of a war of aggression. And a war of aggression means against a country that is not a belligerent country. That isn't, it isn't attacking anybody else, including the people that are bombing it. So it's a war crime by definition, but this time they got the UN Security Council approval for it, and so that just doesn't come up as an issue. It doesn't matter whether they got the Security Council permission or not. It never came up as an issue either in Iraq. And then we have, you know, any killing or any plunder, that's a war crime, and that's a crime against, that is specifically a war crime, any plundering of private or public property, and that's the key here, and wanton destruction of infrastructures or any devastation not justified by military necessity. All of that's going on here, and this is all in violation, in the extremist violation of the very international law they're saying they're standing for, and we have the same pattern again and again. And what's it all for? It's always in order to seize a third world country's wealth, and essentially, in particular, oil wealth, which, as we know, is going short in the world. It's reached its peak. And so that's what occurs. And then never, ever do we have any idea of an alternative possible to this war and seizure of a third world country's resources in violation of international law and war crimes and so forth. We just have that proceeding almost automatically. And one wonders, really, and the thing that is never talked about here is the nature. You know, the U.S. has become a military state, and I think you were quite right in your introduction when you said the only way we seem to be distinguishing ourselves in the world today is by armed force and attacking of other peoples and countries. Well, indeed, that is true, and as I say, in violation of all international law. And why is it really in the interest of the U.S. to do this? It's certainly not in the interest of the U.S. people to do it. We may say, well, it's actually just to seize their oil, but it's not the U.S. people who will get that oil. It's the oil majors, the private money sequencing oil majors that will get access and control of that oil, and they will continue to do as they do now, just hiking the price over and over and over and over again with really no alternative or rationing. Rationing is the one thing that's never permitted, never even arises on the horizons as a possibility, because it goes against the private money sequence system. And I think the private money sequence system is very much involved, what I call cancer capitalism, is very much involved right at the level of the military industrial complex itself. This is the most powerful engine of profit and exploitation and commodity sale that exists in the world, and that's really what's driving this thing. Beneath even the oil is the nature of the military commodity itself. Consider the military commodity. Its nature is to kill and disable other people's lives and their life conditions. That's its nature. That's what it's structured for. Everything it does is structured to do that. But it's not just that it does that in order to remove opposition to the takeover of other people's resources. It's always destroying rather than enabling life. But it's a market ideal of a commodity, because with this commodity, you have instant obsolescence, or you have immediate demand created by the use of the bomb and so forth. So you have a commodity that is instantly used up, or instantly goes obsolete once it's built, either by use or by, you know, the arms race and constantly going to another level, an investment in another level. So in this way, it's an, what other commodity has instant elimination of itself in order to create demand for more? There's no other commodity that does that like the military commodity. So it's the ideal cancer capitalism commodity, ideal. Not only for that reason, but you say, well, normally when people use up or whatever, discharge something, and then it's immediately obsolete or it's immediately used up, that doesn't happen with other commodities. And it certainly can't happen because people can't afford to buy it. Well, what you have here is another ideal nature of the military commodity. The military commodity has infinite demand for it. That is public purse, future debt. Infinite demand for it, now up to $2 billion a day. I mean, think of it. The Vietnam War was $1 million a day. This is now $2 billion a day just to keep this military-industrial machine going. Is $2 billion a day. I mean, it's after the Cold War is over. Well, why does it keep going? Because it's got an infinite demand factor built in through the control of governments by the corporate sector, especially the military producers. So in this respect, too, it's the ideal cancer capitalism commodity because there's infinite demand for it. Even if it bankrupts the countries, it's not just the U.S. that's doing that. Across the world, social sectors are being bankrupted by investment in the military, the cancer capitalism ideal commodity. And so this also, at the same time, destroys, as I say, really always on the firing line, ultimately is the public infrastructures, the social infrastructures, which can then be taken over through new private control, new private investment, new, you know, coming from the tax wallet and so forth, and future debt. But it isn't just that the military commodity is ideal in these ways, but furthermore, it diverts all attention away from what's going on domestically. We have a failed state, really, in the United States. I've been watching a series recently. It's about Baltimore called The Wire. I don't know whether any of your listeners have watched it, but it's very distressing because you just realize that this is a failed state. And this is a very documentary style thing called The Wire. And it's just an example, but it does. We have basically a war zone. It's a failed state, but if you can put divert all attention to a foreign enemy and a foreign dictator and an evil one, then, of course, those problems of domestically, of basically a failed state, a state that's going down the tubes, a state that spent itself giving away, you know, to Wall Street and to the military together, basically giving away all their public wealth, you just divert the issue onto the foreign enemy. Then you have, and you tell another feature of this military commodity. I go through in such detail here because I think we're dealing with wheels within wheels and the cancer commodity of the military unit sale. It also has a high cost per unit that's unmatched by any commodity that exists in the market. You know, they're put out $150 million for a single unit, like a plane, without a motor. I mean, it's just these high per unit costs. Well, that's the worst thing that can happen to the public and its expenditures, but it's the best thing that can happen to the person or the corporations that are selling it, because it's all private manufacturer, corporate manufacturer by these big military industrial corporations.
John,
then you have furthermore subsidy for everything.
Can I add one thing? In America, unlike the European countries, under the European Central Bank, where you've got countries give up the sovereignty to a central bank in a foreign location, might as well be on the moon, so they get themselves in trouble. But America has this wonderful Wall Street operated owned system called the Federal Reserve that, with keystrokes, it can just bring up as much money as the empire needs to further its campaign. In other words,
devalue everybody else's money because it's the unit of it's the way in which people buy goods and settle their debts.
Oh, absolutely.
And so forth. So you can just you can just inflate the value and everybody else has to carry the inflation. And that's what's really gone. That's behind food riots and all kinds of things, is these prices of other things have gone skyrocketing because the U.S. dollar has been inflated. But others who use the U.S. dollar are paying.
Oh, they're paying plenty. And, John, the way the dirty game works is the imperialists in Washington, the government imperialists, decide how much and against whom they want to wage imperial wars, how much it's going to cost. The Congress simply endorses it in a military defense authorization bill. I don't know why they call it defense. It's war.
What
we called it in World War. We had a War Department in World War II, John.
I mean,
we called it what it was. Then it became defense. It's never been defense for this country. It's always been war. And they authorize all this money, and they spend it. And the way they pay for it is they need to issue debt. So they issue treasury bills, notes, and bonds. And whatever foreign countries or other buyers don't buy, the Federal Reserve does. I mean, they can buy all of them if they have to.
Yeah, and pay compound interest back to the banks who lent it to them when they themselves are the ones who back up the banks if the banks go broke. So they basically give away the right to print money to the banks, then pay compound interest back to the private banks, Wall Street, in order for them to lend the money to them that they are ones that back it.
One more thing, John, going back to post-World War II, America, literally, every country America attacked was a non-belligerent. Even North Korea. North Korea did not begin the Korean War. Harry Truman got the South repeatedly to launch incursions into the North, and finally, Kim Il-sung couldn't stand it anymore. It's like being slapped in the face.
Yes.
And you don't want to get into a fight, but somebody keeps slapping you in the face, and finally you haul off and sock them. And that's what Kim Il-sung did, sending his troops to the South, and there we had it. The Korean War started by that big bad Kim Il-sung, and this was Harry Truman's war.
It's still going on
today.
You know, imagine they want a nuclear bomb to defend themselves against us. That's intolerable.
it's little wonder that they do, John. I mean, they've been trying so hard to establish rapprochement with Washington, with the West, and we've turned down every request. It's amazing. It's amazing how we can come up with ways to keep a country an enemy, and if by some chance an enemy no longer is in that state, then we invent a new one. So when the Soviet Union came apart in 1991, John, they needed a new enemy. They came up with the perfect one besides Saddam, an individual. We came up with the war on terrorism.
Oh yes, which we had financed from the beginning, as you know. I mean, the worst terrorism that grew out of the Taliban and so forth was all financed to the tune of billions of dollars in Afghanistan. While it was at that point, these people had been financed to overthrow what was in that region was a socialist government, which had equality for women and universal education and no veil and the rest of it. All that had happened. And then they were being financed and encouraged just the same way as has happened in Libya again. All this is, as you know, they've financed this thing, and they've put in their military advisors. They're working on the ground. They're arming them. They did it even more visibly in Afghanistan, and that's how that whole group got constructed. It did not exist. I've traveled through all those countries before this happened, and the Islamic fanaticism was a marginal thing. That was all financed and armed by the U.S. to the tune of billions of dollars, which created the Taliban and the rest of it, Al-Qaeda. There are creations of the CIA and the State Department and so forth, and Brzezinski, who was very much involved right on the ground, inciting them to take up arms. This is the very same pattern as we see occurring in Libya. And then you wonder, how do the people not wake up to this? How can this go on? And people mystify it and say, you know, people just seem to want to go to war. I mean, they seem to have an appetite for it. Or they're just that dumb. I mean, you got to wake up, John. People are that dumb. all these other reasons. Well, in fact, the reason people don't know about it is it's never talked about in the media, and we go back to the media. It's never talked about what these issues and what's gone wrong. It's never mentioned, and if it ever is mentioned, the hook comes out, and whoever is mentioning is no longer on the program or no longer, they'll actually shut you off if it's on television, or they won't put you in the newspapers. And it's interesting, again, to quote David Rockefeller on all this, the role of the mass media in all this, and he's given us a few insights, and I've quoted him before, as to what's really going on. And he said, and again, it was at a leak from the Bilderberg conference, that he says that actually it would have been impossible for us to have developed a plan for world rule of the sort that we have now, you know, the global market or global capitalist system. We would have never been able to fulfill that plan for the world if we'd been subjected to the lights of publicity during those years. He says it right out. If they'd had a free press in the U.S. and elsewhere, you know, that's the greatest irony of all, calling it a free press again, the Orwellian inversions over and over again. He's telling us straight out that if we'd had a free press, if the press had given the glare of publicity on all that was going on, basically the selling out of your entire economies to foreign corporations, that's what all these treaties are. I mean, that's all they are. If you go through them, that's all the only rights granted are to do that. And he himself acknowledges, well, and thank you, and he's thanking the press, because at the Bilderberg there's people who are head of major monopoly media, and saying thank you very much, because we never could have made this plan. And there you go, world rule, plan for world rule. Those come right out of his mouth.
John,
and you notice what they always did during the Soviet time was always accuse what they want is world rule. Remember, communist world rule. They want communist rule, world rule. You never were able to pick up a paper or hear a speech that didn't allege that. And what they do, it's an amazing operation, is they always project onto the enemy what they're doing themselves. Always. You can almost tell what they are going to do next by what they're projecting onto the enemy. And, of course, they were projecting onto the enemy an intention for world rule, which is actually very implausible, given the fact, as we now know, that the Soviet Union was basically a very large third world country that had socialized its resources and was able to set up some kind of a defense, that they were projecting on it the desire for world rule as a justification for attacking it and the Cold War on it, when in fact it was all along their own design by their own acknowledgement. And so you get to the point where your head begins to spin at how, I guess most of all, how often this can happen, and it's happening again in front of our very eyes.
It keeps happening, John. And if we ever did have a free and open major media, not only could the government under any regime never get away with this, but the governments could never stand, the leaders of any government, Republican or Democrat, if they tried this stuff and they actually began doing it, committing war crimes, they would be impeached. They really would be impeached and convicted. I mean, it would be as simple as that. If the public knew, if the media reported it and the public knew it, the outrage would be so overwhelming that no government could stand in the face of that. So the media literally are complicit in war crimes. And if there was any justice in a legitimate court of law, the media barons would be there alongside the perpetrator war criminals. They would be there as co-conspirators, standing trial and being convicted. And from what you and I are saying, John, you know.
Yeah, they advocated, give me the pictures, I'll give you the war, as Hearst said. This is the same thing now. They would, under law, you know, because if you abet or enable or participate in the planning, et cetera, all of which they go on. And of course, they're, you know, members of the same corporate cancer system, which is, you know, basically turning money into more money for private ownership at the top, and that's all that exists. And war crime is very much, you know, it's not only obviously to sell papers, because papers do sell, the media sells well. You know, that's why they had the bombings at the peak news hours and so forth. So in a way, they're into it. I think you're quite right. They're into aiding and abetting war crime, perhaps most of all, in a way, because, you know, they're participating in the plan. They're participating, actually leading the advocacy of it by their reporting. And, of course, they, who are they? Well, they're monopoly media, as we know. There's almost, you know, almost every city now has hardly only got one monopoly medium going inside it. And this is now the case across the world. And they have an interest in this the same as anybody else, and you might say more, because their co-owners, as it were, are the people who invest all the money, other corporations, large corporations that invest all the money that actually keeps the thing going. It's not people's purchasing, it's the advertising space. So you have a congregation of all the leading cancer capital operations inside the media. It's almost more effective than government.
Oh, indeed it is, John, and it really is shocking and disgusting. And the ones that have the biggest audiences, not so much the print journals, although a paper like the New York Times, it has so much global influence that the stories that they feature get picked up on TV news.
Yeah.
And they feature these hideous stories. The
yeah.
print publications are having a terrible time making a profit. My Chicago Tribune went bankrupt. They still keep operating, but they're bankrupt. Others have gone bankrupt as well. Oh, let's take a quick break, John, and we'll come
okay.
back and pick up on this and more.
Okay.
We will be right back.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Eric Davis, host of Expanding Mind. Join me and co-host Maja Daou each week as we explore the culture of consciousness, spirituality, neuroscience, media tech, and all manner of wonders and esoterica. Expanding Mind streams every Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Keep your mind open.
Gary Knoll. I've been on radio for 37 years, every day, and I'm pleased that the Progressive Radio Network exists, because this is the one form that brings together some of the most important, probing, creative, and dynamic minds on the planet. Join us each and every day, 24/7, on the Progressive Radio Network, your home for independent thinking.
This is Dr. Cheryl Selman from What Women Must Know. You can listen to me every Monday at 2 p.m. I am a naturopathic doctor, author, psychotherapist, lecturer, and passionate women's health advocate. And this is a show all about holistic perspectives and solutions for women's health matters. We have a chance for explorations and in-depth conversations into subjects that women must know. This is all about empowering women of all ages to get truthful information, as well as the chance to explore safe and holistic solutions for women's unique health challenges. And remember, always honor the wisdom of your feminine self.
You are listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Thank you.
back on with John McMurtry, talking about we're likely to go most anywhere in topics. We could go domestic, we could go overseas. The imperial wars, of course, are raging so intensely. John, in an article that I'll finish up this afternoon for tomorrow, again focusing on U.S. and their complicit allies, their imperial wars raging, I really divide the article in two sections. One is on Libya, and I've written so much about that, and the other is on Syria. I wrote only one article on Syria, so I'm getting more about Syria into my article today. There's one common theme between those two countries, maybe among others, but one particularly struck me. Of course, they're both authoritarian regimes. I don't debate that at all. But they're not anywhere near as grievous, bad, extreme as they're portrayed in the West when they want to go after these guys, Gaddafi in Libya, Assad in Syria. But the common theme, John, is that both countries provided, I guess it's pretty tough to do it now, but before the conflicts, provided generous social security, social services in Libya, free education, free health care, free housing help, students to study abroad, generous stipends for newlyweds, housing help, lots more too. Libya is a small country, 6.5 million people, very rich in oil wealth, and Gaddafi, whatever his bad side was, and he could be pretty nasty to his enemies, he was very generous to Libyans who did not go up against the regime. I discovered in working on this article what I didn't know, John, that the Assad regime in Syria, I believe going back to being under his father, Hafez Assad, which was a lot more ruthless than the son. The regime is still the Assad regime, a minority, Alawite, a governing body. I think it represents about 11% of the population of the country, a branch of Shia Islam, and Sunnis and others are more dominant. But they don't persecute other people. Christians live there in peace, whatever the Jewish population may be. I didn't notice that, but if there are some Jews there, nobody persecutes them. And Assad gives generous social services to the Syrian people. Not entirely free, but mostly free health care and education and these other things.
Yeah.
Poverty is something that's very intolerable to the regime.
Yeah.
I mean, compare that to Egypt, to Jordan, to Bahrain, to wealthy Saudi Arabia, to America, John, dare I say more.
Yeah.
And that's the country we're attacking and beating up on, these two countries.
I think this is always the case, as I was saying about social infrastructure, and you're bringing out the really crucial social infrastructure for life reproduction itself at the most basic level of healthcare and education and, you know, just drinking water and food subsidies and everything. This is, you know, I, as well as calling it cancer capitalism, I also use the term, which I have been working out recently, is on the what you might call the internal correlative of cancer capitalism, is feel capitalism, that it's a religion, it's an absolutist religion, and anything that goes more absolutist and more totalitarian and global than any religion has ever been, fanaticism has ever been, and anything that conflicts with it is destroyed as the devil. And what most of all conflicts with it is not private ownership of the means of existence, but public provision of the means of human existence. And you'll notice that every single country that has been non-belligerent, that has been third world, that hasn't had air defenses, that is capable of being invaded, has been invaded, if and only if it has a socialist infrastructure, or a socially owned, or perhaps socialist is too, you know, it's too much of an ideological term, just that the social and public provision of the basic means of existence of being a human being are provided. That is the red flag as the enemy. And you'll notice whether it was Yugoslavia, whether it was back in the original invasion of Iran, or whether it was the invasions of Guatemala or whatever, when anyone came up with a plan, or El Salvador, you can go on and on through the whole list. There's like, you know, one country after another has been invaded, and always they've been invaded. The real reason has been that they had some public provisions of the means of human existence. Thou shalt have no other gods before me is theocapitalist. And it actually follows a very ancient pattern. And just bear with me when I just think of this sort of an inner logic of right from the beginning, back to the Old Testament, has been this, you know, you have an almighty God and a divine design ruling by an invisible hand, always that, and of course we've got our invisible hand now too, and it's always run by non-human laws. Humans can't make their own laws, you know, they come straight from God. You know, notice that's also true of the market, that the laws are inexorable, they're natural, they're inviolable, and so on. So the laws can't be questioned, they can't be examined, they are not man-made, they're not man-alterable, and that's all given. And then you have dogmas, you know, in a case we have obviously dogmas of economic, such as the one that you can't have anything that is socially owned is diabolical, and you know, that there's an invisible hand that regulates things, and you must not interfere with the market and so forth. And so absolute dogmas always rule, whether we're dealing with the Old Testament patriarchal religion or right up now with capitalism, cancer capitalism. There's always conformity to one right way of social rule, and you either conform to it or you don't survive or you don't get ahead. And then there's always privileged priesthoods that stand over what's going on, and they're the only ones who know, and of course that's our economists. And criticism of their particular model, which is always life blind, criticism of their model is heresy, and or at the least nonsense and to be attacked. And thus unbelievers are always unbelievers are vilified as the enemy. You have to be a believer. Think of anybody who says, I don't believe in capitalism. Nobody can say that in the media, and your life may be ruined if that's the case. And in fact, many, even academics, are ruined for that. And so any alternative order, always, whether you go back to the most ancient rituals of bloodletting and so forth, always the heretics are attacked. And if it's a whole people that is different than and is running an alternative system to, you remember when Yahweh says that you shall exterminate the Amorites, the Hebusites, the Jebusites, and all the rest of it, we have the same thing going on now. As you've often pointed out, it's genocidal. Anything that sets up, not just as an individual, but that sets up an alternative order, is genocide. And genocide is a physical sort where you devastate their means of existence and people too. And then it's also a cultural genocide, in the sense that they're not allowed to live the way they have lived or want to live, that they must follow the one right way. And so these first principles are always sacred, and no matter what the life destruction is, no matter what the performance of this theocapitalism, or we might say fanatical witch hunting of the actually early modern period in Europe, or wherever we look, we'll find the same inner meta program operating. And no matter how much damage is done to life and life conditions, it's always right. It cannot be wrong. To say it's wrong is blasphemy. Well, we see that, and I call it basically the inner logic of false religion in all its various forms, that maybe behind this whole thing, behind the armaments, behind the monopoly media, behind the rest of it, is in fact a very fanatical and quite superstitious religion, you know, the belief in the invisible hand and so forth that will always bring optimal results. That we're dealing here with a fanatical theocracy. that doesn't, you know, is not recognized as such. In fact, it takes on the guise of being scientific and secular, although we see with the right wing, with the sociopath right, that they're very much mixing religion, that it really is a religion more overtly, but generally people haven't recognized it as, in fact, a theological fanaticism.
Oh, so true, John. And again, I mean, this game not only goes on without end, it seems as though one event just segues into another, and things don't get better. They actually get worse. I can remember the intense anger at the Bush administration. We can all remember the intense anger at the Bush administration when Bush's approval rating literally hit rock bottom, about as low as any U.S. president in the history of poll taking. He matched surprisingly, he matched Harry Truman at the depth of the Korean War, and
when was that?
I think Jimmy Carter, very briefly in the late 1970s, because the terrible economy, people were having a tough time then, but they're having a much tougher time now, and Bush, because of his wars that people hated, and he was a rotten salesman, so it was very easy, except for the good old boys, and the majority of the country are not good old boys. They just didn't buy his mumbling and fumbling. Obama is a lot smarter. Smoother, and his approval rating still is not that far below 50%. It's sinking. The bounce that he got from the stunt that he pulled off, supposedly killing Bin Laden, that's all gone now, and he's below 50%. I mean, I can't imagine why he's anywhere above 20%.
Yeah.
I mean, the stuff that he's doing and the harm that he's not only causing people abroad, he's causing them at home. People need to remember that every dollar we spend killing and destroying overseas is one less dollar to devote to health care, to education, to desperate needs at home. They're not getting any better. They're getting worse. So all this money is being drained away. Nothing is done to help people here. And we're just going around the world destroying one country after another. I mean, can the American people really believe that these countries threaten us? I mean, it's hard to believe any country, any person, any half-reasoning person. A 10-year-old ought to be able to figure it out, John, that how is Gaddafi going to hurt us? How could Saddam could have hurt us? How could the Taliban have hurt us? How could any of these countries have hurt us? No country can match our strength, and we've got nuclear. My God, in an afternoon, we could literally level virtually any country on earth. If you have big ones like China and Russia, we'd need the whole weekend to do that.
But what if it's a system worship? What if it's a fanatical religion that you know, people just cannot bear? I mean, it's unspeakable, and there shall be no other gods before this. And America is the leading light of the world of this system. And no matter what happens, just like people will, you know, with crusades and the rest of it, they go into a kind of a mad zone. In fact, we've seen that occur throughout history. And what if it is just basically a system worship, which is a form of self-worship, you know, where the people worship themselves inside the system? It cannot possibly be wrong, and therefore any evidence that comes out that it is wrong, that it has gone very badly wrong, that it's life blind, that it's actually destroying the very life infrastructures of the planet, it can't compute. If you've got this regulating group mind of a pseudo-capitalism, where it is this, as they say, a fanatical religion like past fanatical religions, only this time it's got full technological powers, and it is not recognized, but as a religion, so that you can't say, for example, this is all religious superstitious nonsense that's causing a huge amount of problem, you know, I mean, destroying ourselves, that people cannot bring, you know, right at the level of their belief system, that they cannot bring themselves, I can't believe, they say, you know, I can't believe that Obama would, or I can't believe that 9/11 was, say, an inside job, or, you know, the fact that it fell into its own footprint and so forth at the speed of gravity. Now, it just can't compute, can't even compute to the experts. so that you really have basically what we call in philosophy an a priori framework that's regulating all the sense inputs and all the information inputs, and it just rules out anything that doesn't fit this meta belief system, which is a fanaticism of more life-destructive properties than has ever existed on Earth. But as in past ones, nobody can think that it could possibly be wrong, mistaken. I mean, with the economic textbooks, this is the thing. It goes right into the level of the highest level of high science and so forth, is this meta-program of thinking. I mean, you know, the great economist Paul Samuelson, who's sort of his work is a Bible across the world, he says we must spread. He says it right in his own preface after 95, the first, or 91, when the Soviet Union went down. He brought out the religious idea that we must spread the gospel any way we can. And Hayek talked about capitalism he actually worshipped that as God. It's far beyond our sense perceptions and our ideas of understanding. Thy will be done in heaven, not mine. He actually said these things, and he was the leading, as you know, he was the primary economic advisor on a framework level to both Thatcher and indirectly to Reagan through his follower George Gilder. That this is a fanatical religious absolutism.
Really,
and that we're really, you know, we're winding back to a pathology that's operating at the very level of cognition and sensation itself. And anything that disagrees with it, anything that conflicts with it, just won't compute. So you have unspeakables just being, you know, you can't say that. For example, how many people there know that General Motors, DuPont, AT&T, Standard Oil, and Ford Corporation all supplied the Nazis with arms during the war, after 1941?
Oh, indeed, and chemical companies and oil companies and IBM created back in the infancy of technology the punch card system for the Nazis to be able to keep track of the people they put in concentration camps.
That's right.
They
framed the whole thing for the concentration camps. Now, you know that, and I know that, but how many people will I even compute it?
Well, John, Franklin Roosevelt knew about it and didn't do a damn thing about
it. Yeah, that's the amazing thing, isn't it? He found out about it. He got, I mean, you've probably read the same thing, but you know, this does come out in literature, but it's just never talked about in popular discourse or public discourse, and then people just don't want to believe it. And he said, I'm going to do something. And, you know, he couldn't believe it, according to the reports I've read. And then suddenly he went quiet. He just didn't have anything to say. So obviously they had some chain around his neck that they jerked, because he just didn't do anything about it. So during the war, the world war against the worst, well, maybe, you know, the Nazis, here's another unspeakable. How many people know that the Nazis, the East wing of their, that was dealing with Russia and so forth, that there was a Fort Hunt treaty with all the Nazi security experts that had all the records, and there was a secret Fort Hunt treaty where they agreed not to prosecute these people, in fact to give them their wherewithal so that they became an actual office that's, you know, helped set up the CIA, and that they supplied 70% of the foreign intelligence information to the U.S. and to NATO for years and years.
Oh,
how many people know that?
That
we want to hear it.
We enlisted the Nazis that we wanted, John, to ally with us against the Soviets. Oh, it was a General Galen who was one of them.
Yeah, how do you know this? I mean, I know this and you know this, but I don't
see it. Most people know it. I think he was an intelligence expert on the Russians. So that's why he was valued. Werner von Braun, I mean, the Nazi, the guy who invented the V-2 rockets. I mean, he came over here to build our rockets.
Yes.
And there were other, Klaus von Barbie, another butcher. We saved him. And I think we saved a bunch of people whose names that I don't know and most people wouldn't
America.
Know. But we picked and we chose.
We took the ones that we wanted. We didn't give a damn what war crimes they committed.
No.
The Japanese, John, the ones who committed these hideous concentration camp experiments, we gave a bunch of them immunity for their notes.
Yes.
So we know what we did, so we could do the same thing.
Yeah.
That's the way we operate. It's amazing. I mean, most Americans can't believe that the people who run this country really think this way and act this way, but we do. We do it as extremely as the Nazis ever did, as the Japanese warlords did, as Stalin at his worst did, and we've got all this super technology to back it up. So, you know, they might do it against this country or that, or the Nazis against Europe, North Africa, whatever, the Japanese in Asia. I mean, we literally terrorize the globe, and we have a policy in our national security, our national nuclear strategy, maybe both of them, that Washington reserves the right to wage preemptive nuclear war against any country, including non-nuclear ones, on the suspicion that they may threaten America. No evidence needed. The suspicion that they may threaten America, we reserve the right to nuke them. That's official policy.
Yeah, well,
that's
it's
scary.
To terrorize the world. That's why, you know, the whole counterterrorism and terrorism replaced the Soviet Union as the big bad guy that we had to spend all the, you know, $2 billion a day fighting. That is, again, as I say, that's a projection of what we do or what they're doing onto the enemy as the reason for attacking the enemy. I mean, it's just an incredible operation. So that the real terror, and I think it's conscious at the highest levels, that it's consciousness. They just, you know, what are we going to do? I mean, a lot of people are coming to understand, like Steve and John, these things. What are we going to do? Well, just project it. Reagan was the perfecter of this. Just project it onto the enemy as a reason for attacking them. And that you'll notice that operation at work all the time. And I've never heard anybody identify, it's not allowed to be identified as an operation, but you actually think it through and thought experiment and observe what's going on. They always project onto the enemy what they're doing themselves as the reason for attacking them. For example, Iraq, weapons of mass destruction. There weren't any. It was a pure projection. But that was the reason for attacking them. It just exemplifies this operation. And so you just move around inside this circle, and it's, you know, that, not Himmler, but one of the Nazis testifying said, you know, all you have to do, all you have to do is tell the people that somebody's attacking them. And they don't want to go to war, but you just tell them somebody's attacking to them and say anybody who resists is against the country's interests, is being treasonous, and they will be ready to do anything. It's just very, he described it as easy. And so one asks the question, did the Nazis really lose the war? I mean, when you think of how many people at the high end, and I just read, you know, the major corporations, did they lose the war? Or are they, in fact, continuing to operate right from the death squads on and through the nuclear power being the essential terror weapon? Has it essentially continued, and all we've had really are brand changes?
Oh, absolutely, John. We are out of time with the music going. I think that is a key point to end the program on. You know, the name Nazis may be gone. They just took off their armbands and put on a new uniform, so to speak. So the headquarters was transferred from Berlin to Washington, and the same basic regime continues to operate under new management, and it ravages the planet. I just wonder how long it'll take until, heaven forbid, they figure out a way, either on purpose or accidentally, to destroy it. John, I look forward to continuing this next time you come on next month. I mean, this stuff never ends, and it scares me, and it's why I say I'm glad I'm not young anymore. I would not want to grow up in a country and a world like this, wondering how many tomorrows do I really have.
And cancer only advances when we don't recognize it.
Oh, we need to recognize it. Your mission and mine, John, is to make as many people as possible recognize it. Not just recognize it. That's the beginning. Awareness
Respond.
Is the first step to reacting against it.
Yeah.
And we literally have the power to stop it if we'll only use it. John, I look forward to next month.
Me as well.
And to my listeners, indeed, join us every Thursday, 11 a.m. Eastern Time, 1 p.m. On weekends. Make it a regular habit.